This is an ABC podcast.
Drawing room, over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Hello and welcome to RN. I'm Patricia Karvelis and this is RN's Summer Best of the Drawing Room. Coming up later this half hour, we talk about how a group of musicians ended up on an East Coast tour of Australia. It all happened by chance. But first, we hear about conflicts in the Middle East and Northern Africa almost daily, and the reasons behind them are complicated. That's at the best of times. But could an even thornier problem be looming on the horizon? What will climate change and water scarcity mean for a region already dealing with so many problems? One person who's been thinking about that is Gideon Bromberg, co-founder of the EcoPeace Middle East. He's joined me in the drawing room for a chat. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
So let's start with a bit of background. Background's always good. Why water? Is there already a concern or are you looking to the future?
Oh no, water is a major concern in the Middle East, where I come from. At EcoPeace Middle East, we work in Israel, in Palestine, and in Jordan. And the MENA region, the Middle East, North Africa region, is the most water-scarce region in the world. So water is something that no one takes for granted in my part of the world.
So there are issues already, but what changes are occurring? What are you worried about or predicting that's got you concerned?
So climate change is a threat multiplier. Climate change is hitting the Middle East in a, let me put it this way, the IPCC has identified the Middle East as a climate hotspot. We're predicting, the world's leading scientists are predicting a major further reduction in precipitation, in rainfall, in water availability, in rising sea levels that then pollute and increase salinity of already scarce groundwater, major flood events that countries are ill-prepared to deal with. So, on the one hand, it's less water, but when the rain falls, it rains really hard. That means that the groundwater is not being recharged; it's being run off and flowing into the sea. So, this is a major threat to the region. And the reason at EcoPeace that we're so focused on this issue is because it actually requires cooperation. It requires that the countries in the region work together. Climate change clearly is a national security threat from a water security perspective. But these days, it's not enough for just one country to be water secure. If your neighbor's not water secure because of climate change, then that's a threat to your national security as well. And, I come from Israel, which is a world leader in water issues. It's the world leader in treating sewage and then reusing it for agriculture. It's a world leader in desalination of seawater. In fact, 70% of the water that Israelis drink, for instance, is coming from desalination today. And that was never the case until this last decade. So the fact that Israel is somewhat water secure and is able to adapt to the challenges of water scarcity doesn't make climate change any less of a threat to national security when the neighborhood suffers from climate change and doesn't have the same ability to adapt to the impacts of climate change. And we really see it next door in Syria. So, we saw consecutive years of drought in northern Israel, in northern Jordan, and in southern Syria. In Israel and in Jordan, the governments responded somewhat, and yes, we saw a crisis of water, but it was somehow dealt with. Subsidies provided, assistance provided to farmers. Assad, in Syria, the president of Syria, didn't really take note. And the result of climate change in southern Syria meant that hundreds of thousands of farmers literally had to leave their land and millions of people together with the families of these farmers, moved to nearby cities where the Syrian uprising took place. Now, it's not to say that climate change led directly to the uprising, but climate change and the failure of government to respond to the implications of climate change contributed to the uprising. That uprising then not only led to horrible death and destruction within Syria, but millions of refugees. So Jordan next door gets close to 2 million refugees crossing from Syria. That has real water implications for a small country which is already suffering from terrible water scarcity, further impacted by climate change. So the capital of Jordan, Amman, before the Syrian uprising, before the some 2 million refugees crossing the border, was always under tremendous impact of water scarcity. It was receiving water on average 2 days a week. So, you know, people in Australia need to realize that much of the world, and certainly throughout the Middle East and North Africa, that when you turn on the tap, water doesn't always flow. For almost all cities in the region, water is supplied by the municipality flowing into your home in an intermittent basis. So Amman was getting 2 days a week. Following the Syrian crisis and 2 million refugees crossing, water supply in the capital of Jordan is 12 hours to 24 hours a week, cut in half. And that's now a threat to the stability of Jordan itself. So the implications of climate change are really compounded. Mm. It's no longer enough to try and face the issues alone.
Okay, so let's go to that. You said that cooperation is very important, and I think that's pretty obvious, actually, that without cooperation, no country can make a significant impact alone. What sort of agreements do exist? Because we're talking about a difficult geopolitical situation here too, especially when you're talking about Israel and Palestine. How do you work on a joint project when you have those political realities to deal with?
So unfortunately, cooperation is not a given in the Middle East between any countries. In fact, there are almost no transboundary water agreements presently in place, and those that are in place are generally, you know, not respected. So there's a need to build, educate the public and decision makers that there's a self-interest here, that cooperation is not something just nice, something that you should do, but if you fail to work with your neighbour to try and solve these issues, then it's going to be at your peril as well. So, you know, on the Israeli-Palestinian context, water has been a final status issue since the Oslo Accords were signed in 1994-1995. Water back then was seen as a zero-sum game. There was only natural water, and a fair share of that water, of that shared water, also going to the Palestinians would have meant less water to Israelis, particularly to Israeli farmers. And it probably would have led to Israeli farmers blocking the road, every road to Jerusalem, in order to, you know, from their perspective, save their water. Well, that was back, you know, some 25 years ago, before manufactured water, both treated wastewater and desalination coming into play. And, you know, in the last decade, we've seen a real change. Water is no longer a zero-sum game because of the ability to treat and manufacture seawater at very reasonable prices. And that creates an opportunity to actually solve water issues between Israelis and Palestinians that was more difficult to solve 25 years ago, when water was still only the natural water with its very limited quantity. Despite that, despite the fact that water today is much more solvable, we still don't see the cooperation needed, because governments on both sides and much of the international community see the peace process as an all or nothing approach. Either we solve all of the final status issues of the peace process, Jerusalem, borders, security, and water, or we solve nothing. And therefore, in that sense at Equipeace, we really call out loudly that water issues are in fact being held hostage by the failure to solve Jerusalem or other final status issues. And while we want to see all of those issues solved, water issues can't wait. And with the pressure of climate change upon us, where we see a 30% reduction in precipitation today. In fact, the climate models were mostly wrong. They underestimated the implications of climate change in the most water-scarce part of the world. So time is not on our side. Cooperation is difficult because animosity is so high. But this common threat that the region faces and the broader understanding that we're in the same boat, that one country can't succeed on its own. Water security for one country does not mean national stability for that country if its neighboring country is unable to deal with the implications of climate change.
Gideon, thank you so much for coming in.
A real pleasure.
Gideon Bromberg, co-founder of the EcoPeace Middle East. On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis, and this is RN's Summer Best of the Drawing Room. You know, often when musicians are planning a tour, it's their label or their booking agent that decides who hits the road with them. But when William Crichton and the Family Band, featuring the legendary William Barton on didgeridoo, did their East Coast tour, it was with Belfast musician Amy Montgomery. And it all came about by chance at a festival in the UK, as they told me when we caught up a little earlier. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, William Crichton, William number one or two, depends what mood I'm in. Have you and Amy ever been in the same room before?
This is the first time that we're in the same room.
Do tell me more.
Well, we're at a festival in the UK called Black Deer, and I was sitting backstage in my little area, and I heard this voice coming across the park, and I didn't know what to think. And so I chatted to my good friend Bev, who runs the festival, and she told me it was Amy. I tried to get out there, but by the time I got there, she was done. So I haven't actually seen a set, but I heard her, and I tell you what, it moved me very much.
Amy, when did you hear that story?
I heard this story briefly through Instagram, but apart from that, never in person, definitely never in person.
So you hit the Instagram, you got on the gram and thought you'd share this?
Well, these days, that's the way we do it.
Either
that or we sit and meditate and get on that level, but Instagram seems a lot easier, a lot less work.
It's absolutely true. And it's a way of directly getting to people too. You've done lots of touring in Europe and North America. What was it about Amy's sound that hooked you in? Because I imagine you've been in many places and you've randomly heard people. What was it about this sound which was different?
Sure. I think that it's just, she's very honest and authentic, and that sort of draws me in wherever I am in the world and I hear sounds, It sounded like she was just coming out of the ground and that's what I'm drawn to, music is that for me. It's not about what you were saying before, any of the labels. They all play an important part, but music is music. Music's been around since the dawn of humanity, It's how we interact, it's how we talk, it's how we communicate. So beyond the words that we're singing, you can hear that. And I think that that's what drew me to her.
And Amy, you've actually had a huge year yourself. Did you think you'd end up in Australia?
Never did I think that I would end up in Australia, never mind this year, but it's all an all-round surprise that my music brought me to Australia. I think part of me thought that it would be America first before Australia, but no, I went the other way. But yeah, this year has been awesome for us. We've done our first European tour. We've done a long Irish tour. We've played many festivals over the summer, including one of the biggest festivals in the world called Glastonbury in the UK. And obviously the festival where William heard my voice at Black Deer Festival. Yeah, it's been a great year.
And William Barton, the other William, You've toured the world, you've played Carnegie Hall, you've collaborated with symphony orchestras, choirs, classical composers, the list goes on, but I haven't got a year. How important is it to love the music of the people you're working with?
It's very important to, with your co-collaborator, to present honesty and truth through your art form, and that's what makes it speak to the people from all walks of life, and how you engage on stage with your songs and your journey, and hopefully you can open up a comfortable space for the listener to come into your space, not necessarily to educate, but to open up that conversation of what you're trying to portray, whether it's through lyrics or instrumentation, instrumentally, like with the didgeridoo, and how important that is to our Australian people, Indigenous people, and beyond.
You've played lots of gigs with William Crichton before. How do you change gears from orchestral to gritty live folk? I mean, it's a really different way of making music, and even the context is so different.
I think that just comes from experience and being open to conversation when you're working with musicians from across the board, and particularly ones that you appreciate and enjoy their work. And so it makes it much more easier to blend in and also take that out of the space where you might not necessarily hear a particular piece of William Crichton's in the way it has been before, with or without the didgeridoo. And so I'm always about exploring the soundscape within the context of the band, or whether it's with a solo artist on guitar. But my world is pretty much the soundscape, and I'm continuing to learn every day, which is important as well.
For you, William, other William, William Crichton, to be very specific, how important is it to bring the didgeridoo to your audiences?
Incredibly important, you know, to have someone like Will with me, and together I learned so much from him on stage, you know, and it opens up a whole sound that, you know, I didn't really know. I knew it existed, but I didn't know the complete depth of it and how much it could take you on a journey and capture your spirit. You know, you hear those tones playing and those rhythms playing, and a fella like William, he twists. There's so many things happening on the didgeridoo. You know, sometimes you're hearing some German deep dance music. Sometimes you're hearing this, you know, this ancient rhythm that comes out of the earth. It just depends in, I guess, on what's happening, what's unfolding on stage, and what mood he's in, and what mood I'm in. I'm very blessed to have him around playing music together.
It's true, your music does that. You do exactly what he described. You take us all over the place, but at the core, you take us to Aboriginal Australia like no one else. How important is that to bring that to the world?
I guess it's like a canvas that's already there and always has been, and we're just adding our brushstrokes on it and adding our little bit of flavour and colour to it to, you know, different audiences. And, you know, certainly William's got a great following over in parts of Europe, and which he's been building up for quite some time. And this year was the first time touring with William Crichton in Sweden, and we had the festival in Tuna in Denmark, which is a success. And so, you know, I look forward to continuing the exploration of music sonic lines of Australia.
And William Crichton, you often do solo gigs. Why was it important to call on William Barton and also Amy Now and to do this family band for the East Coast tour?
Well, it takes a village.
Yeah.
You know, find people who you enjoy being in the company of and who create great music. I just think, you know,
do they make you perform better as well?
Totally. It's always about lifting the bar. You know, everyone's lifting the bar. Like in the band, I have my brother on the bass and my wife Jules and Will here and Ruben, and we're always trying to lift the bar. And then obviously you have somebody like Amy on the show, you got to be on your toes. So it's all about just lifting the bar and being present and being there and trying to create something that's never happened before each night.
And William, we're about to hear one of your latest tracks now. What have you picked for us?
This is a song called Fire in the Empire. It's the first song of my second album, Empire.
And what should we know about this song?
It's a pretty self-explanatory song, but I will say that the album, sort of growing up in the bush in Australia as a young white fella, you don't necessarily come across the information early about our history as Australia, you know, and so I've been digging and I've been learning as much as I can over the last 10 years to really try and give myself an education. And you're forever learning, happened, and that's what this song is about, coming to terms with the real history of Australia.
All right, let's hear it. This is William Crichton with Fire in the Empire, featuring William Barton on the didgeridoo, and jumping in for backing vocals, Julianne Crichton.
Out where the straight road ends, red dust rises, muddy river bends. I laid down on the sand, fell into a dream. The earth and the crow appeared, the beak of eyes filled with iron tears. Fire in the empire. Fire in the empire. Fire in the empire. I saw tall ships, blood on the wattle. There was a baby buried to a neck on the bank. The water ran red as a white man sank, leaned forward and kicked off her head. Fire in the empire. Fire in the empire. Fire in the empire. Old coke cans and fibro homes, cattle roam on ancient bones. And last night by the Bogan River, I saw a black snake coil and the Southern Cross shiver. Time does not exist. What will you remember? What can you forgive? Fire in the empire. Fire in the empire. Fire in the empire. Fire in the empire.
That was Fire in the Empire by William Crichton, featuring William Barton on didgeridoo and backing vocals by Julianne Crichton, another member of the William Crichton and the Family Band. It's a big family. As we say farewell to Julianne, let's welcome Amy Montgomery, who we've been talking to, of course, tonight as well. Amy, what is it that you want to do with your music?
I think sometimes it's difficult to put things into words, especially when there's a certain exchange of energies between people. What I especially want to do with my music is show people a part of my soul that I couldn't show them otherwise.
Thank you to the three of you for coming in and weaving your stories into this conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.
To remind you of who they all are, William Crichton, William Barton and Amy Montgomery. Now let's hear from Amy. This is Tree Song from Belfast musician Amy Montgomery.
I will not fall over like the root of a tree. My feet are planted. I will only get stronger. Innovation, embrace what's changing. I will not fall over like the root of a tree. My feet are planted. I will only get stronger. Innovation. Changes.
Tree Song performed by Amy Montgomery. And jumping in on guitar, we had there Michael Mormica and Zach Troughton on backing vocals. That's it for the show today, but you can find all of the interviews from The Drawing Room on the RN website or the ABC Listen app. Just search for Drawing Room or RN Drive and be sure to press the star. I'm Patricia Carvelis. I hope you're having a great weekend.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.